schedule. And on the back side is a list of all of the verses in the Bible that mention angels. Now, anyone needs either one of the two handouts. Today's really kind of a continuation of last week's lesson. The introduction to the story about angels in heaven and what they do and why God has angels and how many there are and what do they look like. And we talked about those things some last week. We won't look at all of it. But over the course of the quarter, of course, we will try to be thorough about our examination. Okay, any more who need a handout? We have two handouts. Be sure you get each one. And they're fairly foundational to what we're going to talk about. The fact that there are angels, that God created angels. Last week we emphasized the creation of angels. They don't reproduce. It's not another population of beings that are living in heaven and growing and reproducing and having cherubs and that sort of thing. Cherubs are not baby angels or baby people. And so we'll look at all of that. Particularly in 2 weeks, we're going to look at cherubim. When the Hebrew makes a plural, they don't add S or ES to the end of the word. They add IM. And so when we talk about a cherub or cherubim, that's the plural of the word. And today we're going to talk a little bit about seraphs and seraphim. They're mentioned once in the Bible, and we have to look at that particular situation to see that we're being thorough about the various beings in heaven that we know something about. And that particular story is in Isaiah, the 6th chapter. You might be turning there. And I'll put these scriptures on the screen for you because they're scattered around today. Some of the things we're going to talk about are what do angels do and why are they there and what does God have in store, why does he interact with humans through angels and that sort of thing. Let's see. Isaiah 6, this is the first part of the reading today. And this is a series of verses that have to do with the beginning of Isaiah's tenure as a prophet. He was commissioned in a very special way. And so he doesn't start out his book of Isaiah with this particular information. It's sort of buried further on over in the 6th chapter. And he says, in the year that King Uzziah died. Now, this is one of the kings of Judah. He says, I saw the Lord seated on a throne high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Retrieve my water here. High and exalted. What does that imply? And who is he looking at? Is he really seeing the Lord, or is he seeing a vision of the Lord? He's on a throne, high and exalted. And what temple is he talking about here? What do you think? Is this Solomon's temple? We'll start there. Or is it a temple in heaven? Revelation, we do see that. But I suspect that Isaiah is talking about Solomon's temple. Does he know what the interior of Solomon's temple looks like? Who goes into Solomon's temple? I see some people They don't audibly say the word, but they're saying the word, the priests, right? Priests go inside. Suppose Isaiah was allowed inside? Was he just imagining what he could see if he walked into Solomon's temple or got access to it in some way? And then the scene that he sees the Lord. Now let me ask you this. Is he talking about God? Or is he talking about the angel of the Lord? Who's he talking about? I think he thinks he sees God. Do you think so? Seated on a throne, high and exalted, the one who was the greatest in an appearance like this sat on the seat which was the highest elevation. That indicated their status, right? And so he sees him, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Any of you sewing people know about trains? These are not choo-choo trains. What are they? It's part of the robe, and it's something that trails along behind. And the scene here seems to be something I can't really imagine a robe whose train fills the temple, unless the temple is very small. I don't think that was the case. Do you? So this is a very strange kind of scene that Isaiah sees. Above him were seraphs. Now the King James says seraphim, which is the plural of seraph. And the word seraph comes from a Hebrew word having to do with fire. Each with six wings. We don't know how many, it doesn't say. There are just a plurality of them. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. Six wings. They were calling out to one another. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of His glory. When we talk about the cherubim in 2 weeks, we're going to look at the details of that, because this scene is very similar to the one that John saw in Revelation that we looked at last week, where there were four living creatures who said the same thing, didn't they? And they flew and had wings. Could they be the same four here, just with another name? So we're going to look at that. You might examine that and see if you think that's a possibility. I think it's probably the same thing John saw. And at the sound of their voices, the doorposts and thresholds shook, and the temple was filled with smoke. So what are these creatures, whoever they are, what are they doing? Praising the Lord. Is that a form of service? And does God have creatures that praise Him continually? And do the creatures on earth praise Him continually too? That seemed to be the indication in Revelation chapter 5, wasn't it? That every creature on earth was praising God at the choice of the Lamb who was slain. And that's what we talked about last week. We'll not go over that again. But you can go read about that in the 4th and 5th chapters of Revelation. And they said pretty much the same thing here. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. Are we supposed to be saying things like that too? I suspect that's the implication, isn't it? Do you ever say something like that to God in prayer? I recommend it. But their voices were so strong that the doorposts and thresholds shook and the temple was filled with smoke. That reminds me of the fact that the dedication of the temple, we'll talk about that also in a minute, that when the priests took the Ark of the Covenant into the temple and set it down, they had to leave because the temple was filled with the glory of God. Woe to me, I cried. I am ruined, for I am a man of unclean lips, and I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. We talked about this. Ken's talked about it too, that if you see God, what's that an indication of? Only dead people see God. That's what they believed, wasn't it? So if you see God, you're dead. I'm ruined. From a man of unclean lips, I live among a people of unclean lips, and my eyes have seen the King, the Lord Almighty. So now one of the seraphs flew to me with a live coal in his hand, Isaiah reports, which he had taken with tongs from the altar. Did you ever carry a live coal in your hand? Not for long, and maybe not intentionally. Why did he remove it from the altar with tongs and then carry it in? Why didn't he just reach in and get it? What's the implication of that? It's holy, isn't it? And it might in some way contaminate it to touch it on the altar. What altar are we talking about here? If you know the arrangement of the tabernacle and the temple, then you know what altar he's talking about. There are live coals on the altar. With it he touched my mouth and said, see, this has touched your lips. Your guilt is taken away and your sin is atoned for. What about his lips? Are they burned by this coal? And this is a creature other than God himself who somehow seems to be forgiving sin, doesn't he? So this is a really strange story that Isaiah is telling. We'll not go on with the story. Later on, perhaps we'll look at some aspects of it because he's charged then with preaching to Israel once he's been cleansed. And he was concerned about his unclean lips, and so they did something. Really, his lips weren't the problem, was it? Where do unclean lips come from? From an unclean heart, don't they? And so that has to be remedied in some way. And God talks to him about all of that in the rest of the sixth chapter. And you can read that if you're interested. We want to look at a couple of things about these creatures. First of all, they can talk. That's a surprise, isn't it? They speak Hebrew, apparently. Isaiah understood what they said. And in fact, I bet they speak other languages too. And they can handle fire, and it doesn't seem to burn them. They have a hand, okay? And we'll see when in a couple of weeks. I keep putting you off on this story, but we've got to come back to it. I really want to study angels and Jesus next week. So we'll look at that, and then we'll come back to something similar to this when we talk about Ezekiel. And he saw some really strange things too. And we can't understand what Ezekiel was seeing. Well, we may never understand what Ezekiel was seeing. But perhaps we can understand, get an idea of what he was talking about by some things that we'll mention here later today. So they had hands. What about their feet? We couldn't see their feet. Why? Covered them with one set of wings. What about their faces? Well, their faces were covered with another set of wings. With two wings, they covered their faces. With two wings, they covered their feet. And with two wings, they flew. But beyond the wings, they also have hands. So that's an interesting creature, isn't it? The ones that Ezekiel will see have feet like calves' feet. What does that suggest? Hoofed feet. And so Isaiah couldn't see that. So here's some really strange creatures in heaven, and we get some ideas. They're around the throne. If the representation of what Isaiah is seeing in a temple is similar to what John was seeing in the book of Revelation in the throne, surrounded by the four living creatures, and then there's this set of 24 elders, which seem to be people who had been collected in heaven and for some purpose. Let me give you just a brief view of that. They seem to be people from the Old Testament, and perhaps some from the New, who had gained an entrance into heaven in sort of a preliminary way. They're called elders, and they keep offering commentary to John as you go through the book of Revelation. So they're there for a purpose, but they may not be part of the story. They're sort of like the announcers at a football game. They don't play football, but they tell you what's going on. Yeah. We don't know, do we? He just sees something, and I suspect it's a vision. I don't think he's allowed in the temple, and I think God is showing him something that he didn't expect to see, and it revealed something to himself about his own uncleanness, and that's the point of the story, that he has to be cleansed before he can take the assignment that God is giving him. But the 24 elders, I wanted to mention a couple of things about them. When we studied the book of Revelation, one possibility, we know there were some people in heaven. Now we don't know exactly where in heaven they were, but on the Mount of Transfiguration, who appears? Moses and Elijah. Has God got them in a closet somewhere and he let them out to go talk to Jesus? I don't know. Maybe they're part of this 24 elders. And you can think of worthies in the Old Testament who might have been given some special access to God because of who they were and how well they lived their lives. One such individual mentioned among the fathers of the Old Testament for the time of Noah. Who was it that was taken but didn't die? Enoch, sure. And it also says Noah walked with God. And it also says that there was a man, Elijah, of course, who was taken in a whirlwind. And so there are these individuals that might be in this circle around the throne, added to from time to time. And what did Jesus tell the 12 apostles? You will sit on 12 thrones judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And maybe as they died, they were added to that group. It just happened to be 24 at the time. I don't know. We can't tell about that. But anyway, here are these individuals. So these seraphs. And I think they are the same as the cherubim, but we'll look at that and see if we can decide in 2 weeks from now. Okay. Some things that angels do. And some of these may be the angel of the Lord. Some of them may be generic angels. They may be special angels. If you make the Most High your dwelling, Psalm 91, even the Lord, who is my refuge. Who do you suppose is talking in Psalm 91? Sounds like David, doesn't it? Then no harm will befall you. No disaster will come near your tent. Is that a promise to everybody who serves God earnestly that you'll have no hard knocks in life? If you make the Most High your dwelling, even the Lord who is my refuge, for he will command his angels. So here's the part that has to do with angels. He will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways, to lift you up in their hands so that you will not strike your foot against a stone. You will tread upon the lion and the cobra. You will trample the great lion and the serpent. And you read that and you wonder, was David talking about himself? Well, the devil thinks he was talking about whom? Matthew 4, during the temptation of Jesus. Devil took him on to the holy city, had him stand on the highest point of the temple. If you're the Son of God, he said, throw yourself down, for it is written. And he quotes Psalm 91. He will command his angels concerning you, and they will lift you up in their hands so that you'll not strike your foot against a stone. And Jesus answered him, it's also written, do not put the Lord your God to the test. So you don't test that. It applied to Jesus, and certainly he made God his dwelling, didn't he? And he was one with God. And so what was God promising Jesus in particular about how angels would take care of him? What happens when you strike your foot against a stone? You do that deliberately? Like kicking a football? No, you're stubbing your toe, aren't you? It's an accident. And that's what God was talking about here, and that's what David was talking about. Nothing accidental will happen to Jesus. Would it interfere with his mission if he broke his leg, couldn't walk? My, that would put an end to things, wouldn't it? Because he traveled all over to preach to all of the villages in Israel. So it was important that random chance accidents not happen to him. And I think that's what the angels do, looking ahead toward the end of our course. That's what angels do even for us. That random events could happen and God didn't intend it. Well, that's what angels watch out for. You drive 95 miles an hour in a 30-mile school zone, and no danger will befall you. No, that's putting God to the test, isn't it? You don't want to do that. And you don't do it deliberately just to see if he will indeed come through. See, that's what this is about. Do not put the Lord your God to the test. So although angels watch over your life so that things won't happen to you that God didn't intend, random chance accidents, think of it in those terms, like stubbing your toe. Hey, do you ever stub your toe? Well, you do, but that was a sort of a trivial example that was given here, wasn't it? That's not going to interfere with your life very much. You might even break a toe, and it was still you can hobble around. All right, going on with Psalm 91. Because he loves me, says the Lord, I will rescue him, I will protect him, for he acknowledges my name. And here he seems to be talking about not only Jesus, but also faithful followers of God. He will call upon me and I will answer him. I will be with him in trouble. I will deliver him and honor him. With long life I will satisfy him and show him my salvation. And so he's not talking about Jesus then anymore, is he? He's talking about Christians, I think, and prophecy. So that's what angels do for you, in a way. And we'll reinforce that as we go along. Let's look at another one. Psalm 34. I sought the Lord and he answered me. He delivered me from all my fears. Those who look to him are radiant. Their faces are never covered with shame. This poor man called and the Lord heard him. He saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and he delivers them. So there's angels doing what? Camping around. Reminds me of the story in Job where the devil complains to God about Job being hedged about. Remember that? And you got to drop his force field so that the devil could get to him. And God agrees to do that in that case. But here he says, the angel of the Lord encamps around those who fear him and he delivers them. You know of an example in the Old Testament where that happened? 2 Kings. Story here is the king of Aram who's fighting against the king of Israel, the northern kingdom. And he's troubled because every time he tries to make a move, the king of Israel seems to have anticipated his move, and he says, "We've got spies in our camp." And he says, "Who's not being true to the king here?" The king of Aram asks, and his followers say, "Well, it's Elisha." He says, "Elisha knows everything that you say, even in your bedroom," and tells it to the king of Israel. And so here's the quotation. In the 6th chapter of 2 Kings, go and find out where he is, Elisha is. the king ordered, so I can send men and capture him. And the report came back, he's in Dothan. Then he sent horses and chariots and a strong force there, and they went by night and surrounded the city. And when the servant of the man of God, that's Elisha's servant, got up and went out early the next morning, got to go water the horse or the chickens or something, he went on some early morning task, and an army with horses and chariots had surrounded the city. Oh, my Lord, what shall we do? The servant asked. Don't be afraid, the prophet answered. Those who are with us are more than those who are with them. Who's with us? Here's the king of Aram with all of his horses and chariots surrounding the city, and we're surely going to be captured, and he'll take us away. And Elisha prayed, O Lord, open his eyes so that he may see. And that's kind of what happened when John sees what's in heaven, or John sees Jesus when he was worshiping on the Lord's day. Then the Lord opened the servant's eyes, and he looked and saw the hills full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. What's a chariot of fire? It's a fierce-looking war machine, I guess. They must be rocket-propelled, or what do you think? We don't know what he saw, do we? But it was obvious that Elisha had more power than Aram had. So what happened? Do you know, any of you know what happened in the next part of that story? Have you read that recently in your reading of the Bible? What happens next? Elisha prays, and he says, what does he tell God he wants to happen? He says, strike them blind. And the Lord did so. And this whole army of people were blind. And then Elisha led them into Samaria and presented them to the king. And these people, then he said, open their eyes. And they opened their eyes. And there they were surrounded in the city of Samaria, prisoners of the king of Israel. And he asked, shall we kill them? And Elisha says, no. Prepare a feast, let them have food and water, and then let them go. They went back to the king of Aram, and the king of Aram never bothered them anymore. That was the proper response, wasn't it? So here, you get in a situation, and you say, I'm surrounded by enemies. You can imagine something like that. We don't live in a land where we have lots of enemies. But maybe you felt surrounded in the past. But if you could open your eyes and see, what would you find? All around you are God's forces taking care of the situation. If what? If you're faithful to God. Yeah, you can't expect that just to rescue you when you get in trouble and then don't serve God the rest of the time in your life. It's the faithful who have this kind of protection in their lives. And maybe you need to consider the fact that your past track record has an effect on whether or not this sort of thing happens to you. But it can be this way if we're faithful to God. All right. Hebrews, the first chapter. The writer of Hebrews, I think it was Paul, was comparing Jesus to angels. That whole chapter is kind of interesting about angels, but to which of the angels did God ever say, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet? To whom did God say that? To Jesus, yes. Did he say it to any angels? Not as far as we know, do we? But then this interesting sentence. Are not all angels ministering spirits sent to serve those who will inherit salvation? How many angels? What fraction of the angels? All. angels. What's a ministering servant? Spirit. A ministering spirit. What does it mean to minister? It's to serve, isn't it? To be a servant. And they're spirits, and so we don't see them because I think they're outside of our three-dimensional universe, but they're very, very, very close and very able and powerful and able to make differences in our situation. And they serve us if we are faithful Christians. How do they know what to do? Suppose you get a dumb angel in charge of your... Do you ever worry about that? And I think there may have been stories written about that sort of thing. I'm not real sure. They don't do what they do of their own accord, do they? Where do they get their instructions? They get them from God. He tells them what to do. So there's one mind behind all of their activities. Now, how many angels did we say there were? Last week we looked in the book of Revelation in the sixth chapter. I was in the fifth chapter. How many? A myriad of myriads and thousands more. We were talking about a myriad of myriad is 100 million. Excuse me. A myriad is 10,000. 10,000 times 10,000 is 100 million and more than that, multiplied more. And why so many? We got to look at that question later on. Is why does God need that many angels? And we'll look at that later. Be thinking about it. But this is a key verse. It should give you some comfort that God knows what's going on. Not only do the angels do what God asked them to do in your behalf, but they report to God. That's a pair of eyes watching and reporting back to God about what's going on in your life and how you're being attacked or how you're being tempted and what the devil's doing to you. And God responds to what they report, and they do whatever God says to do. So somebody's in charge, you see. It's not all random events, and you're just caught up in the turmoil of our world. Okay, now I want to spend the rest of our time looking at some of the things we looked at last week. For the sake of you who weren't here last week, I'll hurry through this. We're going to talk about dimensions because I think, and this is an opinion of mine, and I can't bind it upon you, but as I look at it throughout my life, I've been trying to understand this, and I think this is an explanation of things. Yuri Gagarin, I think that was the right Russian cosmonaut, went into orbit around the Earth and he reported, I don't see God anywhere. He's not out here. He's not in outer space. Where is he? Well, there are three dimensions to our world. Up and down, right and left, and front and back. And we are embedded in a three-dimensional world. And so we have the opportunity to look at the possibility of a two-dimensional world. So if you have a structure like the one you see on the left, it's a two-dimensional structure made up of squares. And you can take six squares and fold them like this to make a three-dimensional cube. And that three-dimensional cube is projected back into the two dimensions of the screen. So we have to, it's kind of confusing because you have to think a little bit about what we're talking about here. But you can turn this cube in three dimensions any way you want to. And you can see that the squares are really square, but when you project it back into two dimensions, some of the squares are parallelograms there, as you see in the right-hand figure there. Now you can take six cubes, and this is where we blow our minds, eight cubes, and make a structure like this called a tesseract. And 8 cubes, mathematicians assure us, that you can fold 8 cubes in four-dimensional space. And I have trouble with that, trying to do it, because you can't handle four dimensions, can you? But if you do, you make something called a hypercube. And mathematicians work with this quite a bit. So these 8 cubes can be collapsed into a four-dimensional structure, and you can make five-dimensional structures and six and seven. And the interesting thing is that even dimensions don't make good universes. Two dimensions are a problem for a universe because you can't have an axle through a wheel. And so there's a lot of machinery and stuff you can't make. But as we talked about last week, there's a story written by A.K. Dewdney about the planiverse in which he imagined a two-dimensional universe that we can examine as three-dimensional creatures. So we look at this world, and here's a two-dimensional creature living in a plane. And so he can only see things in the plane. He's made up of atoms that only interact in two dimensions. And so all of the molecules in his world are flat. And his universe is only as thick as an atom. Everything is in that one plane. And of course he needs help. He's facing to the right, and he can't flip himself around to look the other way. You'd have to pull him out of two dimensions and turn him over to look to the left. And so here you have a very limited kind of a creature in two dimensions. But Dewdney looked at that and he said, well, now wait a minute, we can make some creatures that are better formed than my triangular individual here. Incidentally, he can't cross his legs, so he has to walk sideways. He can't. There's no front and back. And he lives on the planet Ardae, the ones that we'll look at in a minute that are a little more sophisticated than that. And the planet Ardae is a two-dimensional planet. It's just a disk, a flat disk, not quite like what is it that we throw? A frisbee. It has to be flat. But it rotates, and it has ocean on one side and land on the other side. And up here, you see a lake, because the rain falls upon the land and it can't run off. It can't run in three dimensions. So he lives up here on the land somewhere, and the story and the handout will give you some clues about what his possibilities are. And so here's Dewdney's two-dimensional creature. And it's interesting that as we look at him from the third dimension, and this was a thing we emphasized last week, you can see his innards. You can see his guts, to put it crudely. You can see his nerves. You can see his muscles and his bones. And because you're in the third dimension, he's totally unaware of your presence. But if you stick your fingers into the plane of his world, all he sees are just the cross sections of your fingers. It's very difficult for a three-dimensional person to get into a two-dimensional world. So what's the solution to that problem? Will God really dwell on earth? The heavens, even the highest heaven, cannot contain you, how much less this temple I have built. And that's what Solomon said at the dedication of the temple in Jerusalem after he finished building it. God can't dwell in a three-dimensional temple. He's more dimensions than that. He's either seven or eight or nine or many more dimensions than we have. And so he can't dwell in our universe. So what's the solution? Well, he created the universe, so he's created angels that can hear an angel inserted into a two-dimensional universe, flat into the screen, can talk with Yindrid, who's the creature that's there, who is able to talk. Incidentally, Yindrid is writing on a tablet. What kind of words can he write? He can only write dots and dashes down the tablet because it's has no third dimension. So it's kind of like Morse code. But anyway, the angel says what angels always say, fear not, and delivers a message. Because he's in two dimensions, he can participate in all of the things that the two-dimensional creature can participate in. And so God can send three-dimensional creatures, angels, into our three-dimensional world and talk to us. God himself doesn't come into our world. He's too complex. And in fact, if you make a universe which is something that you can control, fewer dimensions than the one you live in, then you have to have a mechanism in order to interact with it. And I think that's what we're talking about with angels. Okay, now let's look at this in a different way. Lord, show us the Father, and that will be enough for us. Do you remember Philip talking, the apostles talking with Jesus just before his crucifixion? And Jesus was sort of amazed. Don't you know me, Philip, even after I've been among you such a long time? Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and the Father's in me? The words I say to you are not just my own, rather it is the Father living in me who is doing his work. What's Jesus saying? I came into this world to represent God, you see. In a three-dimensional world, God is more complicated than I am, but I am in the Father, and the Father is in me. Hebrews 1. In the past, God spoke to our forefathers through the prophets at many times and in various ways. But in these last days, he's spoken to us by his Son, whom he appointed heir of all things, and through whom he made the universe. The Son is the radiance of God's glory and the exact representation of his being. That's the phrase we want to focus on here. Sustaining all things by his powerful word. He looks like God. And if you've seen Jesus, you've seen God insofar as a three-dimensional human creature can see. That's why he came, to represent God on earth and to, of course, show us how God wanted us to live. He's the image. Remember the word image? God said, let us make man in our image and our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea, the birds of the air, and over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. The image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. You have any images? If you have a picture on the wall, it's the image of your grandmother. Does it look like her? Sure. And you can recognize it, but it's two-dimensional. You realize that. It's not three-dimensional, is it? It's an image, something missing from the way the original looked. It isn't alive, for one thing. So when we see an image, here's an image. It's a two-dimensional image on the screen. But your mind readily sees mountains in the distance, waterfall in the intermediate distance, flowers in the foreground. And so you infer a three-dimensional image, don't you, from a two-dimensional. You infer a three-dimensional reality from a two-dimensional image. And that's what we have to do, and we have that to look forward to. Our citizenship is in heaven, and we eagerly await a Savior from there, the Lord Jesus Christ, who by the power that enables him to bring everything under his control will transform our lowly bodies, us, as we know us, so that they will be like his glorious body. And that's why the resurrection is so important. You have to be transformed into something greater than what you are now. And you will have a body like Jesus' body after he was resurrected. So That's how you convert the image back into the original, isn't it? And so we'll be like him. That's what we have to look forward to. So you see, the business about images and about dimensions and all has a bearing on this. The angels don't just appear out of smoke, out of thin air. They've been hovering around us outside in a direction we can't point. And they come into our world, slide into our three dimensions. That's what Jacob saw. Angels ascending and descending at Bethel in the Old Testament. There was a portal of some sort there where they were coming into our world and going back into theirs. Okay, that's it for today. But next week we're going to talk about how angels had such an important role in the birth and life and death of Jesus. Thank you.